I participated in this practice. I'm perfectly okay with that. And as an individual with a disability and someone who grew up feeling really ashamed of himself, these fleeting moments of intimacy gave me an opportunity to feel really good about who I was in a way that nothing else ever had. You have to look past the question of morality or immorality and look at the way in which I think the practice has provided for many men throughout decades, opportunities to find a place to belong to.
Even centuries.
Right.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine, I'm Lucia Chappell. Hong Kong High Court cans criminal gay sex laws, World Health Organization cures its gender identity terms, and Espinoza explores the radical art of cruising. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Laura Dickinson Turner.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 1st, 2019. A Hong Kong High Court judge has struck down several laws criminalizing consensual adult gay sex. In his May 30th ruling, Judge Thomas Au Hing-Cheung overturned the colonial-era laws as discriminatory and unconstitutional because they specifically targeted gay men. He wrote that no comparable offenses exist for heterosexuals or female homosexuals. The government had no defense for the charge of discrimination, so any appeal is unlikely, according to the Associated Press. Two of the laws criminalize the procuring of a man for buggery or for gross indecency with another man. Another law carried a possible life sentence for buggery with a boy under the age of 16, while a man convicted of having sex with a girl under 16 faced a maximum of 5 years in jail. Hong Kong decriminalized homosexual acts between consenting adults in 1991 when it adopted its current Bill of Rights and Basic Law after the British handover to China. However, that constitutional document kept the archaic anti-gay sex laws. A government commission had been reviewing those provisions, but an impatient activist from a Hong Kong LGBTQ rights group brought the court challenge. Michael Vidler, of the firm representing plaintiff Yung Chiu Wing, complained that this legal challenge should not have been necessary.
Lawyers for Hong Kong's government were also busy this week fighting a legal challenge to its heterosexual-only marriage laws. They argued on May 29th that opening civil marriage to same-gender couples would dilute and diminish the institution and make it no longer special. Attorneys for a lesbian, known only as MK, are arguing in the court of first instance that preventing her from forming a legal union with another woman violates Hong Kong's equality and privacy guarantees. Government lawyer Stuart Wong countered that not all differences in treatment are unlawful. You are not supposed to treat unequal cases alike. He also rejected civil unions for lesbian and gay couples and claimed that to recognize an alternative form of same-sex relationships, which we say is tantamount to marriage, is to undermine the traditional institution of marriage and the family constituted by such a marriage. MK's lawyers responded that the government's definition of marriage is equivalent to a private members club for heterosexual couples only. Encouraged by the advent of marriage equality in neighboring Taiwan, the well-known lesbian heiress Gigi Chow has formed Hong Kong Marriage Equality. A press statement from the new group asserted that marriage equality doesn't make marriage less special, it makes it even stronger. This is only one of three same-gender couple cases currently being heard in Hong Kong's courts. No rulings are expected anytime soon.
The World Health Assembly voted on May 25th to remove gender nonconformity from its catalog of mental illnesses. The Assembly is the governing body for the United Nations-based World Health Organization, or WHO. The WHO also changed gender identity disorder to gender incongruence in its diagnostic manual and moved it to a separate section on sexual health. The International Classification of Diseases is virtually the Bible of healthcare providers around the world, including in the 194 countries represented in the Assembly. In some countries, a diagnosis of gender identity disorder is required for transition-related medical care or for a change of gender designation on government documents. It will be up to each country to update laws that use the old definition. Human Rights Watch LGBTQ specialist Graham Reed said that the move will have a liberating effect on transgender people worldwide. Reed noted that it's the stigma, discrimination, and bullying, and not anything inherent in gender nonconformity, that can inflict mental health problems in transgender people.
Pakistan's human rights minister has for the first time hired a trans woman to join her department. Dr. Shireen Mazari made the announcement on Twitter on May 30th. She wrote that Aisha Mogul will work as a resource person. The response thus far has been generally positive. One Twitter user called it a great step, while another said it was refreshing. Someone else tweeted, "They have a complete right to secure a respectful place in society." Dr. Mazari became the Minister for Human Rights last year after a long career as a professor of political science. She was also the editor of the Pakistani newspaper, The Nation. Parliament may have also helped lay the groundwork for this latest trans advance. It passed the Transgender Persons Protections of Rights Act last year. That measure established sweeping protections for transgender people, including the right to self-identify on government documents and the right to access public services, such as schools, hospitals, and public transit. In another sign of progress, the police force in the province of Sindh is now accepting transgender candidates. The police chief told NBC News in April that it was time to offer more opportunities to transgender people, who he said are often relegated to menial jobs in Pakistan.
Italy has its first transgender mayor. Pink News reports that voters in the town of Tromello elected 40-year-old lawyer Gianmarco Negri by a 12-point margin on May 26th. In the town of 3,700, his nearest opponent in the four-candidate race was right-wing conservative Renato Capa. Talking about his journey on a local TV show, Negri said, "I've always felt like a man. I tried to repress my being a woman several times, but 4 years ago, I took the first steps to transition." When asked if he considered himself to be a symbol for transgender rights, Negri said simply that, "I try and do my part." Fabrizio Marazzo of the LGBTQ rights organization Gay Center told Gay Ireland News and Entertainment that his group was hopeful that the coming elections will see more gay, lesbian, and trans candidates elected for a more inclusive Italy.
The United States Supreme Court has essentially upheld the right of local school districts to establish trans-friendly bathroom policies. The court refused to hear an appeal of a case involving Boyertown Area High School in Pennsylvania. Both a federal district court and the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had rejected a challenge by the Alliance Defending Freedom, representing a group of Boyertown students and families. The certifiably anti-queer hate group objected to the policy that allows trans students to use campus restrooms and other single-gender facilities that most comfortably match their identity. Legal counsel Christiana Holcomb told reporters that these types of school policies have serious privacy implications. The ACLU represented the Pennsylvania Youth Congress, a coalition of LGBTQ youth organizations. It intervened on the school district's behalf to defend the trans-sensitivity policy. Staff attorney Rita Marr said it was an enormous victory for transgender students across the country. The Supreme Court has already agreed to hear three cases in its next session to determine if LGBTQ people are protected from workplace discrimination in federal law. The session begins in October.
Maine and Colorado this week joined the 16 other U.S. states that have banned so-called conversion therapy for minors. The debunked practice claims to use prayer and other approaches to change LGBTQ people into conventional cisgender heterosexuals. Maine's new Democratic Governor, Janet Mills, signed the bill into law on May 29th, saying, "We send an unequivocal message to young LGBTQ people in Maine and across the country. We stand with you, we support you, and we will always defend your right to be who you are." An almost identical bill was vetoed last year by Maine's previous governor, the controversial far-right Republican Paul LePage. To no one's surprise, on May 31st, Colorado's gay Democratic governor, Jared Polis, signed a bill outlawing change therapy for those under the age of 18. Advertising such services is also specifically illegal in the state. Polis also signed a second bill that makes it easier for trans and non-binary people in Colorado to change the gender designation on their birth certificates. Both bills stalled in the previous session when Republicans controlled the state Senate. The new Democratic majority sent them each sailing through both legislative chambers.
And finally, A monument to two trailblazing transgender activists of color will soon grace New York City, just as queers and their supporters begin to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the fabled Stonewall Rebellion. Legend has Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera among the leading rabble-rousers at the Stonewall Inn in June 1969, when customers fought back for the first time against what were then routine police raids and arrests at gay bars. Both Johnson and Rivera were gender nonconforming and led the formation of a number of trans rights groups. Rivera led the movement to change the word transvestite to transgender in order to differentiate trans women from female impersonators. A $10 million allocation from the city towards new public artworks will fund the monument project. Johnson and Rivera's monument will reportedly find its new home in Manhattan's Ruth Wittenberg Triangle, close to their old home for fun and frolic, the Stonewall Inn.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 1st, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazor, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And now you can listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Laura Dickinson Turner.
Last time on This Way Out, queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason learned something.
The first thing was I learned that cruising can have a cultural context.
The author himself talks more about the history of gay men on the side streets after this Rainbow Minute about the beginnings of gay pride marching down Main Street.
Gay pride events worldwide, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Before the rebellion at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village on June 28, 1969, advocating for homosexuals was known as the homophile movement. After the riots caused by police harassment at the Stonewall Inn came the birth of the phrase gay liberation movement and the use of the term gay pride. In fact, the site of the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street is seen in the name of the first anniversary of the gay liberation movement, called Christopher Street Gay Liberation Day. It took place on June 28, 1970. Surprisingly, simultaneous smaller marches took place that same day in Los Angeles and San Francisco. A year later, in 1971, gay pride marches also took place in Boston, Dallas, Milwaukee, and cities abroad, including Paris, West Berlin, and Stockholm. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Nancy Waldo.
Hey, everybody, this is Leah Delaria, and you are listening to This Way Out.
My eyes adore you.
Hello, I'm John Dyer V. Our guest on This Way Out is Alex Espinoza, author of the new book, Cruising, An Intimate History of a Radical Pastime. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's great to be here.
Can you describe for us what is meant by the term cruising? And we'll note here that your nonfiction book is not related to the 1980 William Friedkin film of the same name, though you do discuss the movie in your book.
Right, right. The book, Cruising, An Intimate History of a Radical Pastime, looks at the practice of cruising in the gay community. That is, anonymous sexual hookups between men in public places like bathrooms, rest stops, parks, adult bookstores. And I chart the evolution of the practice from ancient Greece all the way up to our more contemporary times. So I look at apps like Grindr and Scruff and how they're changing the idea of cruising and hooking up and what it means to continue this practice. I think the book examines closely the evolution of it, how it's changed, how it's changing, and what it means in communities and places like Uganda and Russia, where being gay is a crime, and how you find opportunities to hook up with men despite some of the really dangerous conditions that these individuals find themselves in. And sprinkled throughout the book are my own experiences as a gay man growing up in a very closeted anti-homosexual society, very Catholic, and how I developed my own sense of sexual identity through my own experiences cruising when I was younger. Though I know that there are some instances of cruising in the straight community and cruising between women, the book specifically looks at the experiences of men cruising.
Right, and that would not be flirting either. You would differentiate between flirting and cruising.
Right, exactly.
So tell us about the genesis of the book. Did you have the idea for it over a long period of time?
You know, it was something that I'd been toying with. I was writing a novel. I was knee-deep in the research of a novel about a young man who finds himself financially strapped for cash and ends up having to resort to selling himself for money. And so I started playing with that idea, and then it kind of evolved into a closer examination of the ways in which power dynamics play out in the practice of cruising. And I started doing more and more digging, and I started thinking closely about it, about the concept, and you know, looking at the ways in which apps and computers are really changing what it means to cruise. And that's kind of how it evolved. And I had an opportunity to discuss this with my editors at Unnamed, and they really liked the idea and sort of pitched me a potential outline for it. And I felt like I needed to incorporate my own personal experiences into it. And that's kind of how it evolved. It sort of evolved into this research book, while at the same time I was sort of having a conversation with my own experiences and looking at, you know, as a gay man, as a disabled man also, the ways in which this practice allowed me an opportunity to gain some kind of self-confidence in a way that I hadn't experienced before. And also, it was enlightening to have an opportunity to sort of demystify, I think, a subject that for a lot of individuals is very taboo, right? This idea that, you know, you have individuals hooking up and having sex in these public places, and dispelling some of the myths around it and looking at it as an act of resistance and rebellion within the gay community. Was also important for me to touch on and discuss. And I was inspired very much by the, you know, the body positivity movement that's going on right now, especially among some writers, some female writers, who are looking now at, you know, these conventional ideas of what beauty and femininity are, and really sort of challenging a lot of those ideas and taking it upon themselves to say, we can be, you know, we don't have to be size zero. We can be, you know, larger, and we can be sexual, and we can be proud of our bodies. And being really forthcoming about that, I think, was really empowering and very inspiring. And that was what motivated me to want to sit down and tell my own experiences about this and to say to the world, you know, I participated in this practice. I'm perfectly okay with that. And as an individual with a disability, you know, and someone who grew up feeling really ashamed of himself, these moments, these fleeting moments of intimacy, gave me an opportunity to feel really good about who I was, and in a way that nothing else ever had. I'm going to read the prelude, which is the beginning of the book. You have to practice patience when you cruise. You need to be alone for long stretches, often looking for something that isn't always there. It takes time to cultivate this skill. It takes time to learn how to identify the cracks, to see the openings, to recognize the breaks and tears that exist in the ordinary. It's meditative. It reminds me of writing. Both require a level of isolation, of quiet solitude. Both ask you to reach deep inside, to look inward, to sit with your memories and thoughts while everything hurls forward as you wonder what the pursuit is all about, what will be revealed at the end, how will the color of things change when one comes out of this journey. It's a moment that captures something unnameable but feels crucial for survival. It's an impulse so strong it boils the blood. It alters time and reality and sense. And the only way one gets better at both is by returning to it, doing it over and over again and again. Cruising taught me how to cultivate a sense of confidence. I learned how to walk a little more slowly in the world. I learned how to observe and watch and wait for the revelations, for the climax, if you will, to come. Cruising made me right.
I'm John Dyer V. Our guest on This Way Out is Alex Espinoza, author of the new book, Cruising, An Intimate History of a Radical Pastime. You make a strong case for your position, both historically and personally. What do you say to those folks who would argue that cruising is immoral as well as unsafe?
What I would say to them is, to each his or her own, I think. I think that you have to look past the question of morality or immorality and look at the way in which I think the practice has provided for many men throughout decades opportunities to find a place to belong to.
Even centuries.
Right, exactly. To find opportunities to connect and to release, I think, some of the hidden tensions that for whatever reason they may have within them. And, as far as safety goes, cruising was happening, during the AIDS crisis. Men were still participating in cruising, although you do see a dip in the presence of, say, bathhouses, but it was still going on. Men took precaution. I think in a lot of those spaces, it was the first time that we started having discussions about safe sex, right? So I think those are questions that are always going to be there. And I think that that's what makes it such a unique, apparatus for discussing the way in which, as a society, we are often trying to find ways to connect with individuals just like us.
Your research on the topic is so thorough. Were you surprised by anything in particular that turned up in your studies?
There's a moment in the book when I talk about this incident that happened in Mansfield, Ohio in the 1960s, when the Mansfield Police Department caught wind of the fact that there was a bathroom in the Mansfield Central Park where men were cruising, and they installed a camera behind a two-way mirror and were secretly recording these moments unbeknownst to the men that were in the bathrooms. And artist found the reel and repurposed it for an art piece that ran. And I had an opportunity to view the reel, and it's incredibly, incredibly, incredibly both intimate and very disturbing, because you're watching this very grainy, old film reel that's jumping of these men engaged in these very personal, private acts, and they're being recorded. And you really see a cross-section of 1960s America. It's, white men, black men, thin, overweight, businessmen, working class men, every spectrum is present there. And it's both incredibly intimate and very troubling. And I think it's also a sort of heralding, I think, a lot of the things to come in terms of the way in which apps and computers are now sort of beginning to kind of invade our privacy when it comes to something like this. And also one of the things that was incredibly surprising to me and very reassuring as a gay man was sort of looking at how resilient the gay community and the LGBTQ community have been throughout the decades and centuries, that despite so many moments when our identity was being questioned and targeted, we've found ways to rebel. We've found ways to protest. And I think the act and the practice of cruising is a perfect example of that.
What has the reaction been so far to the folks who have seen the book?
So far, the reaction has been very, very positive. You know, I've gotten some really great blurbs from writers like John Reshi, Gerard Conley, Jordy Rosenberg. Kirkus Review has really liked it. And so it's gotten some really great early reviews, and I'm excited about it, and I'm very humbled by that, by the endorsements.
That's just wonderful. This has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Is there anything else you would want your audience to know about the book, or just about their perceptions of what you're trying to say here?
The concept of cruising has been with us for a long time. It's no different than any practice, cultural practice that a community participates in order to maintain their survival and their autonomy, that it's absolutely necessary in a lot of ways. And for a lot of individuals who are living in countries with very strict guidelines regarding sexuality and homosexuality, it's an act of survival. Their very lives depend on it. And I think that we should refrain from casting any judgment aside about it, and really taking a look at how it provides an opportunity for people to look past, I think, a lot of the pain and the hurt and the loneliness, that it's an opportunity for many men in so many ways to connect and to be intimate and to be human, I think, which is what all of us want.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I've been talking with Alex Espinoza, author of the book Cruising, An Intimate History of a Radical Pastime. And for This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Laura Dickinson Turner and John Dyer V, produced by Brian DeShazer, from Nancy Waldo, produced by Jed Proctor and Brian Burns, and from John Dyer V, produced by Greg Gordon. Barry Manilow performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KTWH Two Harbors, Minnesota, GaySA Radio Pretoria, South Africa, KGHE Alma, Washington, and some 200 stations and other outlets around the world, including this one. Now y'all stay tuned.